Matt Alford, back on the pod. How's it going?
Well, I've been a lot better since you said that we're only doing this audio because my chin looks fat.
Well, now everybody want to see your chin.
Do you want to start
like,
it again?
At least the picture.
I've just taken away loads of the books that were propping this up, and actually, weirdly, by going from further underneath my chin, it looks less fat.
So, what do you think now? We should make a video.
Right.
So you're in a rush, right? Because you've got a gig later today.
I'm not in a rush. I was just concerned because I also had a couple of other meetings about. I've got a hectic life at the moment, Daniel. I'm going to Glasgow to promote documentary Theatres of War. We've talked about here on this podcast previously. I went to Geneva the other day to talk about Julian Assange.
Oh yeah, what was that all about?
Didn't I tell you? I thought I was just going to give a talk for an NGO, a non-governmental organization. And then they ended up taking me to the UN in Geneva, and I had to give this presentation about.
Do you think you might have been getting arrested or something?
It was something of a peculiar experience. So that's been going on. And
so who is at the UN? Aren't Russia in control of the UN now? Is that right?
Well, I went because Iranian people wanted me to be involved. That's why I thought I was just giving a talk to like an Iranian NGO. And then when I got there, there'd obviously been like quite a miscommunication in general. Because they kept on asking me to talk about human rights, and I was like, yeah, all my stuff's sort of human rightsy because I believe in human rights. And then I actually got there in person, and I'd sort of got this anti-war rant that I'd written with which was dripping in sarcasm and had a few jokes in it. And then I twigged about 9 o'clock the night before I was meant to do this thing that they'd brought me to Geneva not to do like a little talk to a little group of whoever the hell they were. I didn't know who they were, but they were actually taking me to the UN to give a proper presentation with all the people with the little microphones, and you know. So I had to rapidly change my speech and make it really formal. But fortunately, I do know the Julian Assange case quite well, and now that we've raised it, I should just sort of mention Julian Assange is in prison in Britain in Belmarsh, and
everybody knows that. Well,
yeah, I think
anybody that would be listening
to this, yeah. But there are some people who don't know.
Yeah, no, I met a girl at a party the other day who said she'd been on like a march for anti-austerity, cost of living. And there's all, you know, you get all sorts of people there. You get the socialists come out, the unions are out. And she said, oh, and I saw some people with like Julian Assange, free Julian Assange. I was like, I haven't thought about that in 10 years.
Exactly, because it's not really been in the media, and it's certainly not been in the entertainment media since 2013, as documented elsewhere. But yeah, it's funny, the things that people don't know what they are. I remember having an argument with, I didn't have an argument, but I had a disagreement with my friend about 10 years ago just after the NATO invasion of Libya, NATO bombing of Libya. And she was not aware. You know, she is someone who like teaches eco building. She's really environmentally conscious, really switched on, just didn't know, just hadn't followed that there'd been a war on. And I sort of chastised her for this, I remember at the time. I was like, yeah, you must know. She was like, yeah, I know loads of things that you don't know about climate change. And so screw you. And I was like, oh, yeah, that's actually a really good point. Why should, you know, and also what can you do unless there's a big movement?
Yeah, I wouldn't blame just people randomly in the world who don't know things. It's really the media's job to sort of put out the stories that are most important, that are most relevant, and that's, you know, because it's like, it's not that we live in a society that censors that much information. You can get pretty much everything, but it's, you have to go out and find it. You know, I think that the anti-Semitism thing is a classic example of that, where, you know, the information that people, that's generally known in the country is quite a sort of small, quite biased take on what's happened. And people just think, well, that's like the level of how everyone else is informed, and I'm on that level. So, you know, I'm as informed as you are expected to be.
Yeah, I think that's the thing, isn't it? Is to really understand. Oh, I don't know. Forget it. It's just a thing.
Well, no, I do think like there is. There are a few. I don't know much about the war in Libya. I know that it took place. But when it comes to the anti-Semitism thing, I do know a lot about it. And when I watch any news report about it, I realize I know more than
the person who's reporting it. Yeah.
I know that some of the MPs either are pretending they know more than they do or openly lying. And the person who is like, you know, the presenter of the show, they have absolutely no idea what's going on. And you think, well, I know about this topic. Maybe that's the case on all the other topics I don't know about. And that's just how the news is.
And this is why when you have that kind of question about political affairs, which is, in fact, George Galloway asked me this because I was on his show a couple of weeks ago. He said something like, you know, do these people know what they're doing? These war planners, do they know what they're doing? Or are they evil or whatever? And there's no real answer to that. Like, because there is a mix, isn't there? Some people are just cognitive dissonance. Some people are really evil. Probably people like John Bolton are probably psychopaths. And then there are some people who are just a bit dumb. And also there is a huge swathe of people who are a bit slow and who just don't know that much about it, or even sharp, but don't know that much about it because it's a complicated topic and they've got loads of other things going on in their life. That was like my friend. About the Libya thing, she just knew loads of other stuff and she was focused on loads of other things. And why should she know, you know, the biggest war that was going on at that time? I mean, it seems silly to not, but why should you? You know, nothing you can do about it. So that's the problem with that. All these systems that are end up being really oppressive, they're never going to be all evil people or all fit people. They're a mix of everything. That kind of means that there's possibilities to change that, but also it makes it difficult to change as well.
Yeah, well, I love your optimism there. I'm increasingly despairing, to be honest. But
well,
let's
I
move
have
on
to be
this
the
article.
Optimistic one, because every time we do one of these podcasts, it's a fucking misery fest.
But I think, well, actually, what we've just been talking about kind of links into this article that I showed you last week. So basically, what happened was I was on the train. Going into London on Thursday night. And the front page of the Guardian website was this article, Vulcan Files, leak reveals Putin's global and domestic cyber war tactics. And it's all spread out like one of these big, massive leak sort of news stories that you get, you know, often about offshore accounts and stuff. You know, you've had, what were those in the past? They all have stupid names.
Panama Papers, and there was another one, wasn't there?
And I thought, oh God, so this is like the new big thing. So it was the front page. It had these glossy graphics and I read the article and it was just hilarious. I thought it was a really fun thing to read. And then I sent it to you and I thought, well, let's make a podcast about it. Cause this is probably going to be this huge thing. And I haven't heard anything about it since. And I went on Google today and all of the stories bar one were from 5 days ago. So they all came out on that Thursday, I guess. And then it was like, was one from like 3 days ago from like some website I'd never heard of. And it's like, okay, so it's just, we're still going to do it. We're still going to talk about this article, even though it doesn't seem to have had any impact whatsoever. It's still an interesting article because, you know, for those that do read it, it's just such, I think it's such a window of like projection on the part of The Guardian and the writers and basically the sort of Western way of looking at foreign intelligence, foreign cyber attacks.
I think it's really important because even if it doesn't get a great deal of play in the media, probably because it doesn't really add up to that much, which is the impression I get from what I've read around it. I've not studied it in any depth, but even if it doesn't, it means that there's always a talking point for the defenders of Western empire to be able to say, ah, well, what about the Vulcan files? What about the... So there's always something, to, you know, what about when Russia interfered with the election in 2016? There's just a series of obvious things that just makes it really difficult for critical voices to get through, because there's always a way of saying, oh, well, what about this? And that is something that's going to take up time. That's something that always needs to be handled, somehow dealt with by whoever's talking about it. And then it's just like, ugh, it makes it so much harder.
The files might not be, they might not really reveal anything at all, but they just add to this wider narrative. And in the article it brings in all of those other things. Because, you know, Russian cyber attacks and Russia sort of propaganda and infiltrating, elections and stuff. This has just been a sort of ongoing story. And so anything that can add to that is helpful.
It just gives the illusion of credibility, doesn't it? Like the more books and articles that are out there, just makes it look like there's something to it. But at the end of the day, how powerful is Russia? Not very powerful. That's the end.
Well, let's see.
As far as I'm concerned, there's not a great deal more to say, unless there's evidence suggesting that Russia is able to do all this bullshit that they keep saying, like they're going to take over Western Europe or overthrow elections and blah, blah, blah. It's just the rest of it is just candy floss.
Well,
candy floss in the shape of a pair of bollocks.
Like all of the stuff they bring up, we'll get into right now, is stuff that is obviously intelligence agencies are capable of, you know, in theory. But obviously, the obvious intelligence agency that could pull off these sort of things is the US. And that's kind of brought up tacitly as it goes along. Anyway, it starts off. The inconspicuous office is in Moscow's northeastern suburbs. A sign reads, Business Center. Nearby are modern residential blocks and a rambling old cemetery, home to ivy-covered war memorials. The area is where Peter the Great once trained his mighty army. Inside the six-story building, a new generation is helping Russian military operations. Its weapons are more advanced than those of Peter the Great's era. Not pikes and halberds. I didn't know what a halberd was, but I looked it up. Do you know what a halberd is?
I'm going to guess that it's some kind of helmet.
No, it's like what the orcs have in Lord of the Rings, but longer.
Halberd. Okay. Yeah. I suppose a helmet wouldn't be a weapon, would it? A helmet would be defensive capability.
I don't know what. So the weapons are more advanced than Peter the Great's era, not pikes and halberds, but hacking and disinformation tools. The software engineers behind these systems are employees of NTC Vulcan. On the surface, it looks like a run-of-the-mill cybersecurity consultancy. You know, your run-of-the-mill cybersecurity consultancy. However, a leak of secret files from the company has exposed its work, bolstering Vladimir Putin's cyber warfare capabilities. Thousands of pages of secret documents reveal how Vulcan's engineers have worked for Russian military and intelligence agencies to support hacking operations, train operatives before attacks on national infrastructure, spread disinformation, and control sections of the internet. I was a bit like, not sure about control sections of the internet. I don't know what that means. If the internet's in sections or what have you. The company's work is linked to the Federal Security Service of FSB. So there's a lot of, there's FSB, GOU, GRU, SVR. And I know I should be supposed to know what these things are, but like Russian agencies, it's all just sort of like these secretive organizations. And it's just sort of building up this idea of this network of evil, I suppose, going through Russia, which I don't doubt exists, but it's just very much the norm for like any country, right? Particularly
any
like
country would have these kind of capabilities. Yeah, that's the thing, isn't
like
it?
All countries really have like loads of, you know, different organizations, MI5, MI6, FBI, CIA. It's just scary because we don't know. We've not heard of them before and they're Russian. Then it's got this really cool like flow chart of how it works, which is all in Russian. So it doesn't really, I don't know why that's there. One document links a Vulcan cyber attack tool with the notorious hacking group Sandworm, which the US government said twice caused blackouts in Ukraine, disrupted the Olympics in South Korea, and launched NotPetya, the most economically destructive malware in history. I like, caused blackouts in Ukraine twice, disrupted the Olympics in South Korea. It's like such a random sort of, I don't know what's their goal.
I know what their goal is. That's to make Russia seem like a global threat, because otherwise it's just doing something on its border. That's the whole point, isn't it? They have to internationalize this. at every step. And that's why the Russian interference in the 2016 election allegation, for which there is very threadbare evidence, but it is still an extremely important part of the overall narrative, the fabric, what do we just call it? What did Luke Harding call the internet? Sections.
Sections of the internet.
We think of the world as sections. This whole story about global threat from Russia and China, it has to be internationalized at all points.
Otherwise, people
are just like, oh, well, that's just happening over there. And that can
be. If you're taking it in good faith, though, it's like blackouts in Ukraine. I mean, that's not ideal, but to be perfectly honest, what Ukraine's going through, it's the least of their worries.
Yeah. And they're at war. They are at war.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not very surprising that there's going to be that kind of thing happening.
Disrupting the Olympics South Korea, though. Like this group Sandworm, they're so devious. They've done all of these things like disrupting the Olympics. So I looked this up, and what is it that apparently the only thing I could find in a Washington Post article, which is all about that, but it basically talked about how it was definitely the Russians, you know, that was the whole argument, not what they did. And all it said about what they did was that they like attacked some computers and some people's tickets wouldn't print out, so they missed the event.
Yeah, those blackguards.
Which, you know, it's frustrating for sure. But,
yeah,
you know, yeah. I just don't know if it's like something that's worth bringing up. How long ago was that? 10 years ago?
Yeah.
11, it'd be like it's, when Putin's in like...
I hope they charge him with
it. On the war trial. And let us not forget people's tickets. anyway... what else does it say? Codenamed Scan V, or I guess Scan 5, it scours the internet for vulnerabilities, which are then stored for use in future cyber attacks. So that's the system that they used apparently for the Olympics and the blackouts and whatnot. And then they list some other systems. Another system known as Amazit amounts to a blueprint for surveilling and controlling the internet in regions under Russia's command, and also enables disinformation via fake social media profiles. And that's, again, I'm sure it's all true and, you know, not great for people that have to live in those conditions, but that's exactly what all countries do, isn't it?
I think so.
Yeah. A third Vulcan-built system, Crystal 2V, is a training program for cyber operatives in the methods required to bring down rail, air, and sea.
No, not Putin's plan to destroy real ale.
A file explaining the software states the level of security of processed and stored information in this product is quote unquote top secret. That's the top of the secret things.
Yeah. Yeah, Russia shouldn't be able to have secrets because it can't be trusted.
Well, they can have some secrets, not top secret.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Yeah.
The Vulcan files, Russia, which date from 2016 to 2021, were leaked by an anonymous whistleblower angered by Russia's war in Ukraine. Such leaks from Moscow are extremely rare. Days after the invasion in February last year, the source approached the German newspaper Süddeutsche Zeitung and said the GRU and FSB hide behind Vulcan. People should know the dangers of this, the whistleblower said. Because of the events in Ukraine, I decided to make this information public. I think that's interesting that before that, he was quite happy with Russia spying on its own people, disrupting the Olympics. He didn't care about it, but then only when they invaded Ukraine did he think it was bad. Anyway, the company is doing bad things. Probably a poor translation of what he said. The company is doing bad things, and the Russian government is cowardly and wrong. I am angry about the invasion of Ukraine and the terrible things that are happening there. I hope you can use this information to show what is happening.
Has this statement been written by ChatGPT? Dear ChatGPT, what would a whistleblower say?
Yeah, exactly. The source later shared the data and further information with the Munich-based investigative startup Paper Trail Media. I don't know much about these guys. For several months, journalists working for 11 media outlets, including The Guardian, Washington Post, and Le Monde, have investigated the files in a consortium led by Paper Trail Media and Der Spiegel. So it reminds me very much of the WikiLeaks, I suppose, in a way.
Yeah, but on a really small scale.
But on a really small scale,
in
yeah.
Every way
this is to,
imaginable.
This is to be praised, whereas WikiLeaks was bad, remember?
Yeah.
Five Western intelligence agencies confirmed the Vulcan files appear to be authentic. Oh, yeah, I underlined this. They confirmed that it appeared to be authentic. It is not known whether the tools built by Vulcan have been used for real world attacks in Ukraine or elsewhere.
All right. So everything you've just read, we can't really confirm any of that at all.
Yeah, that comes halfway through the article, which it's a nice thing to say. But Russian hackers are known to have repeatedly targeted Ukrainian computer networks, a campaign that continues. Since last year's invasion, Moscow's missiles have hit Kiev or Kyiv and other cities, destroying critical infrastructure and leaving the country in the dark. And it's like, yeah, that sounds really bad. And that is not a computer hack.
That's irrelevant. That's missiles doing that. So that seems like a weird shift of point.
It does. You're an academic. How would that go in an essay?
I would just cross it out and put a big question mark by it and then go and kill myself.
Oh, yeah, that's the classic teacher, like the sort of sarky red pen question mark. Analysts say Russia is also engaged in a continual conflict with what it perceives as its enemy, the West, including the US, UK, EU, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. Why would they think we're their enemy? We're all friends, aren't we? Is that the Guardian's take? All of which have developed their own... Oh, yeah, this is it. So including the US, UK, EU, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand, all of which have developed their own classified cyber offensive capabilities in a digital arms race.
Yeah. Yes.
So I'm like, I mean, there is an interesting thing here with some of the things that they bring up about what Russia may have done and probably have done. It's like, well... Let's get into some of those and let's look at it more as a kind of, well, this is how wars are fought now. And it's not just that because evil, bad Russia are doing it. This is what all countries are doing. And I think there could be a really good article about how that works in terms of the sort of Cold War of cyber attacks, right?
Yeah.
But this is just like sort of mentions them like in really sort of hysterical terms without any detail and just says, oh, and Russia's doing it and they're evil. So, you know. I don't know what's the point. Is the point that we should be able to do that? That Western countries can and should do that, and that's fine, and we shouldn't even look into it. But if Russia does it, then that's bad.
If Russia does it, which we think they are, but we've just said that they might not be, because we have to be accurate a bit in what we're saying. Yeah, it seems like such a partial and something of a non-story, isn't it? But it's nevertheless one that, as you say, has been smashed over the front pages of these various big newspapers. But all it's really doing is describing the capabilities, perfectly understandable capabilities of a great power.
Did they do this in World War II? Were they like, Germany are inventing planes? They're things that can fly over and bomb cities. Can you believe what the Germans are doing?
Yeah.
And it's like, everybody's doing that. That's the technological position that we're in. That's the advancement of the world at this point. It's like very bizarre.
Yeah, it's straight. I read an article by Craig Murray about this, which I felt sort of critically analysed what was going on, pointing out how few of the actual documents have been put into the public domain as well. They've only put about one page of these thousands of pages.
The
Vulcan files. now, I don't think that necessarily means that I'm not saying that they're bogus, they're not being made up, but I think that they're really complicated and technical, and that's the way that they describe them in one of the pieces. But it also kind of means, well, maybe they sound a little bit like a sort of very dull handbook on how to do some hacking. This is not very. I mean, remember when WikiLeaks and Edward Snowden released, the Vault 6 and you know how surveillance works. You know, there were some quite clear diagrams there as to like how the West steals information from people, how the West can hack people's computers, how people can plant information in people's computers, all that kind of thing. And you know, that was really, you know, go out and look that stuff up. There's none of that here in this Vulcan thing. It's all just like, yeah, they've got some capabilities to use the internet, and they've got a Wi-Fi connection now, these bastards. So Craig Murray's piece is really worth looking at on this. And he talks about, yeah, very lack of information, lack of the actual documentation in the public domain. I'm trying to think what else he says now, but yeah, basically like what you're saying, that, you know, of course they're going to have these capabilities, but what are the implications? The implications they've not bothered to elucidate. It reminds me of that Luke Harding has done did a book called Collusion. This goes back to what critics like me call Russiagate, although they officially call Russian interference in the US presidential elections of 2016. And his book was called Collusion. And then I looked into him being questioned about that subject, and someone, I can't remember the interviewer now, basically says, so what's the actual evidence of collusion? And he keeps talking around and around the subject and distracting, never actually gets to the point of saying how there was collusion between Russia and the Trump administration. It's just all allusion to that. So, you know, the very point of his most famous book, I think, is just the word that describes his main book is just incorrect and inconsistent with his own argument. So I think there are just people who, it's just journalists, isn't it? They're just trotting out stories. They want to fight. There is an angle here. It sounds like it's worth reporting. They've got hold of some documents, and you know.
Yeah, I mean, you could write. But to me, it should have been parody article, right? Really. You could write like this article where you just find any laptop that's owned by a Russian, and you just open it up, and you just say this could be from Russian intelligence, and then you just see what's on the laptop, and then you just sort of interpret anything that's on it. Like, this could be a map of, like, so for example, this is the next paragraph in the article. Some documents in the leak contain what appear to be illustrative examples of potential targets. So it's a map. One contains a map showing dots across the US. Yeah, that's what most maps do. They normally like represent cities or mountains and things. Another contains the details of a nuclear power station in Switzerland. It's like, okay, yeah, I mean,
sounds sinister.
It probably is sinister, but it's like, I mean, what does it? And it doesn't. It just gives you that information. Presumably, if there's thousands of files, it's like, well, do they have a map of all power stations in the world, or do they have a map of detailing all of Switzerland, which includes the power stations? Where is this? What's the context within this map of a nuclear power station in Switzerland? Like,
yeah, I suppose, to be fair to them, they might just not know the answer to that.
No, but they decide.
It does seem strange. I mean, of all of the places to that Russia would be interested in nuclear power stations or attacking, you know, Switzerland surely is the last place they'd want to attack. Although maybe they would, but it's not a NATO country.
That's good.
So maybe that's the implication, or maybe that's a genuinely good point. Maybe that would be Russia's surprise move. Instead of attacking a NATO country, they'll use salami tactics. They'll attack a neutral country that hasn't got a defense pact with anyone else, and that will mean that they are able to create instability in Western Europe, but without triggering Article 5.
That's pretty clever.
Oh, I've talked myself around. Yeah, I'm with you guys. Well done, The Guardian. That's what those dots meant in America. The dots on that map and the picture of a nuclear facility in Switzerland convinced me that Putin's next move is to destroy a nuclear power station in Switzerland in his attempt to take over Britain.
Right.
And he'll be saying there are.
Well, how is he going to take over? How is he going to take over Britain without attacking NATO? Is it going to be it's entirely like he's based in Switzerland and there's got cyber attacks on all the computer and infrastructure in the UK.
Yeah, and we're doing it
somehow he takes over the entire, we're never actually fighting us, and we just have to.
Yeah, exactly. All be done cyber so that so they never invoke Article 5, because that's what he's really afraid of. Right, he'll take over Switzerland, he'll become like king of Switzerland, and then mount his invasion from there, deep in the heart of the Swiss mountains.
But that's where you were, right?
That's where I just was, yeah.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh no! Don't catch me for my Putin links.
You with all your like pro Putin propaganda. Just come back from Switzerland, secret meeting. Yeah, I see what's going on. Do you ever listen to Ghost Stories for the End of the World?
I don't. But that sounds good.
It's a good podcast. Yeah, you should check it out. It's all about the history of, I guess, of cyber warfare, of sort of US intelligence using computers. And there's this one program they use called Promise,
which was
invented in the 80s. And it just spread throughout the world. And this article, I just kept thinking they were going to bring it up, because it's just this sort of classic, like, we'll just throw that in. It's always a thing to throw in if you're ever in doubt. Because it goes on. One document shows engineers recommending Russia add to its own capabilities by using hacking tools stolen in 2016 from the US National Security Agency and posted online. So, yes, it would, yeah, use the US, much better cyber terrorism of the US. Yeah, get that involved.
Yeah. I don't know if we should give this nonsense much more airtime.
How long have we been going? I don't even know.
Don't know. It's
we haven't even got to the Vulcan's chief executive. The chief executive, Anton Markov, is a man of middle years with cropped hair and dark bags around his eyes. Yeah. That's all you need to know about him. The company is part of Russia's military industrial complex. I thought that was an interesting line. So Russia definitely has a military industrial complex. America doesn't, because that's a conspiracy. Vulcan's corporate culture is more Silicon Valley than spy agency. So then it goes on to talk about how inside Vulcan, like, they do all these nice things, like they have birthday parties for employees. They've got upbeat slogans like make the world a better place. And it's like, that's where I just really think the projection is. Yes, that's what happens in Silicon Valley, Facebook, Twitter, all that kind of things. But that doesn't mean that they're also not working with the security state.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't know. I feel like I'm repeating myself. But it just seems obvious. At the end of the day, how powerful is Russia? It's not very powerful. It can't do the things that it's mythically that we're constantly told it can do, that it wants to do. So
it can do some of it.
Need to treat those countries accordingly. But it's like this. It reminds me of the Chinese spy balloon thing. You know, it's similar. It's like, in fact, I saw it in the paper this morning. You know, the spy balloon apparently that went over the United States did take photographs of whatever sensitive installations and blah blah blah. And they sort of say, you know, and beamed it back to Russia and beamed it back to the Kremlin in real time. So maybe they can do that. But what's the implication? Who gives a shit? I mean,
why wouldn't they beam it back in real time?
Exactly. What are they going to wait? They're going to take Polaroids and then
they've only got dial up, so they had to wait until he was on the computer.
And then they have to wait for the balloon to land, and then a little Chinese man gets in it and flies it off, and then takes the Polaroids.
He has to physically take the floppy disk out and then run to Beijing.
Like, what is that? And in fact, even the way that was reported in the press this morning, I noticed that they talk about how there's been numerous Chinese incursions in US airspace, but they don't talk about what is apparently that there's been several incursions by the United States using similar devices into Chinese airspace which happen every year. So I'm not. It's just trying to get these things into proportion. And if you don't,
well, that's the thing. All of these things are constantly going on all the time. And yeah. I think, you know, I think Russia is capable of this stuff, or there's like no evidence. Yeah. There's as much evidence that there are or there isn't. I mean, it's top secret, or we don't know what they're sharing.
We don't know
if this is even like, I mean, how do they even know that this data leak isn't by the Russians themselves? Who fucking knows, right? So it's just, it's constant information warfare, cyber warfare, but it's not a news story where like something has happened, right? This is a constant thing.
It's not really news. It's news because they've stretched it out to be news because there's some new documents that have been
but the same with the hot air balloons, right? It's like this fits.
Yeah, it's just part of this. We're just describing the way that the world's been working for God knows how long.
So you're trying to build this narrative. I mean, I always go back to the anti-Semitism Labour Party classic, but you know, it's the same thing. Right. You have people online shooting their mouth off. You have members of the Labour Party that might say some stuff from time to time. You have disagreements at CLP meetings. You have people that leave the party for various reasons, political reasons. But if you start to amplify the voices of some of these people and also not question their motives or whether they might be lying, then it starts to form this narrative. So like you start to say, well, look at all these hot air balloons in the US.
And then you
start to, you know, speculate on the motive of that and just come out with the most damning reason that's possible. And then you don't look at the spying on China itself, and you don't sort of China a right to reply, or you dismiss.
It's the classic way of making a moral panic, isn't it? It's the equivalent of, or even the same as, a moral panic. I do think sometimes it's very difficult to know exactly what's going on. There was an assassination, wasn't there, a couple of days ago in Russia? I think it was.
I don't know about that. I was at a party. It was a major... talking about how I knew about Julian Assange.
Oh, you're too busy showing off instead of reading the.
Yeah, so I missed that one.
I've been away myself, but basically there was a big major assassination of a Russian military blogger in St. Petersburg. I'm trying to remember. But I think it was, anyway, he was, and it looks, you know, the Russians have blamed Ukraine. A woman, 26-year-old woman, was asked by someone, supposedly Ukrainian, to take a model of this Russian military blogger, a model of his head, like as a bust, as a sort of golden bust.
Like papier-mâché.
And don't know what it was actually made of. And then he was presented with that as a surprise when he was on stage giving a speech about Russian foreign policy. But inside there was a bar of soap size explosive, blew up, killed 30 people, killed or injured. I can't remember if it was killed or injured 30 people in the cafe and killed him. It was a big explosion. I've seen it on BBC footage. So anyway, the point is, it looks like it's probably Ukraine that did that, but Ukraine have denied it. They've said, you know, we've got other priorities right now rather than killing military bloggers.
Where was he? He was based in Ukraine.
No, based in Russia. So there's a big bomb, a big terrorist attack, or whatever you want to call it, in
St. Petersburg.
I think it was St. Petersburg. Killed quite a few people just a couple of days ago. But then I've seen commentators talk about how actually this could be maneuvering with, it could be infighting between, within the Russian state, for example. Because that kind of person who just got killed could be a contender to fight, you know, to defeat Putin in future or whatever it is, or he might represent those kind of people. So this is the thing, we can never quite know. And I don't want to be at pains to stress that, but when I'm dismissive of these things like balloons and sort of internet capabilities and stuff, it's not to say that I know or that me and you know exactly what it all meant, but it's just trying to pick through in kind of common sense terms what it seems to mean. And from what we can tell of reading that about those things, the balloon and the Russian capabilities, it seems very thin what they're talking about. And even with the balloon, do you remember they were trying to determine if it was a military balloon or not?
Did they have military training, this balloon?
Yeah. Yeah. That would be more like a space hopper.
Space hopper, but carrying machine. It goes deep undercover. It's like Jason Bourne. Yeah. Like it just, the military training just snaps in when it needs it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
The killer space hopper, yeah. This time it's personal. But anyway, even with that, like the evidence went missing, didn't it? Like they tried to pull it out of the pull the balloon out of the water, and the key one of the key parts of the balloon dropped it or something and went to the bottom of the ocean. So it all seems a bit like
obviously the main story that we're not really even talking about here is Nord Stream 2, right?
Yeah,
really the crux of all of this kind of.
And like, did you
clearly see, something happened, but yet no one can explain.
Did you see in the? You were probably too busy partying and showing off how brainy you are about.
I know all about the news.
International politics.
I don't even have to watch it anymore.
There was an article just I think yesterday. I'm trying to remember where it was now, but it was quite a prominent piece about how Nord Stream 2, the bombing of that pipeline, is what do they say like a. Someone from NATO described it like a corpse at a Christmas party or something like that. Basically saying no one wants to talk about it. Everyone's just ignoring it. No one in NATO will discuss it. It's just like this taboo subject. And in fact, I spoke to a think tank person a few weeks ago, and he was saying something similar that his people, like which are all like the Germans and the French and the British and various others who are part of kind of a discussion thing on foreign policy, that they just don't talk about it because it's just like
why?
Just because partly I guess because A, no one really knows the answer, so perhaps it's a bit embarrassing that they don't know the answer, and but B, then, because the Americans probably did it.
Instead of being embarrassed, why don't they think about why they don't know? Why are they being denied the information? Like, where's the information? How do they normally know things? Where does that come from? And why?
Yeah, but do you know what, Daniel? That's like a really fundamental point, isn't it? It's like me and you are reasonably comfortable, I think, in saying, well, it's like the old phrase, isn't it? If it looks like a duck and it talks like a duck, it's a duck. But actually, it might be a duck in disguise. It might be a Chinese balloon. Might be a Chinese balloon with a bill stuck on it with Brit stick. So there are people who, you know, working in these kind of organizations who are officials, they're accountable, their credibility relies on it all. And if they don't know the answer to it, sometimes they just have to say, well, we don't know. And if it was done by a secret team of people from what were they talking about? A team from Sweden and in collaboration with the United States, and you know. Then no one's going to know. People like me and you are happy enough to say, well, it's almost certainly that, isn't it? It's almost certainly the United States.
I imagine the Brits were involved. I don't want to get egos involved here, but the US intelligence statement did say that it definitely wasn't the US and the Brits. So that makes me think that it was the US and the Brits. Because why would you even mention Britain?
Yeah, Britain was nothing to do with it. I didn't say anything about Britain. But anyway, I guess there's something about expertise there, which is not. I do think it's incredibly political as well, and it's all bound up in deception and power and all that. But there is also, I think, there are probably people who are just like, well, I don't know, and it's my job to be accurate about what the extent to which I can know stuff.
But the Guardian could put pressure on these sort of narratives and organizations that
you certainly have thought that up. Asking the question would be is not beyond the remit of journalists or of a newspaper, you know, exactly. To put together the information, and that would put some pressure on to do it. It reminds me a little bit of it's too much of a stretch perhaps, but. It's like the Kennedy assassination. I was going to say to some extent. It's like
we're not going into
this for any length of time whatsoever. But I mean, you could ask again and again, couldn't you? You could keep having that kind of story questioned in the press. But actually, if there's nothing to it, then that might mean that the press looks the newspapers look rather silly to be keep on asking questions when there's nothing at the end of it to find out. So I can get a certain amount of reticence.
Okay, in theory, you know, one person can assassinate a president, I guess, if they're in the right place at the right time. But, you know, a small, like a group of random people on a boat can't destroy a pipeline.
There was no lone gunman on the Nord Stream pipeline. It was a massive coordinated plan. And then also a cleanup campaign by the looks of it, which I think was done by the Swedes. So, yeah, there's not really a way around. You'd have thought that at some point that is all going to come out because you can't. It's just obvious.
Well, this is my despair. This is where I've got to now, which is that yes, it will come out. It may come out,
but
very
too
soon,
late.
But no one cares, and it doesn't. Like, I feel like a lot of stuff's coming out about the anti-Semitism thing. I'd say even with COVID, right? Like the sort of very strong hardline position people had on the vaccines and stuff. I mean, people had were strong on the anti-vax view as well, but the official narrative was very pro-vax, and that's but some of that was turned out to be wrong, like, you know, whether you could transmit it and stuff. And it's it doesn't mean that the vaccine doesn't work, but you have to still admit that there was a bit of fake news there, right?
Yeah,
what
was
happening, and they never and that's kind of come out, but it's like there's not really any. I don't know, there's just no repercussions for that. And it's the narratives kind of, you have, they're always complicated, basically. And it's very silly to have a very strong line on anything like this. And so as details come out later, you would think that that would start to make things difficult for people that were fronting these kind of things, like, well, Keir Starmer and Boris Johnson, and Keir Starmer again with the anti-Semitism thing. But there's not really, well, all that happens is it's just like, okay, well, yes, it wasn't exactly what we thought it was. Here is more likely the more complex, you know, more likely what happened, which is more complex truth, but with the caveat that it's years later and nobody cares.
It's definitely a we are living in an era of regressive politics, and when, you know, even these revelations aren't necessarily gonna turn things. But
I mean, it's the same with the leaks, the Iraq war files, right? Which should have had repercussions for Tony Blair.
Yeah, completely agree. What to say about that? In a more positive way.
Well, I like the fact that who is it that was this Putin is now a war criminal, but for like a really weird, it was like people trafficking or something.
Oh, is that what he's down for? Is it?
Yeah, they got
like
him on
like Donald Trump being done for.
Yeah, so there's this kind of warfare thing.
Payment wrongly.
Yeah. He didn't pay his OnlyFans correctly.
Yeah.
Like, they do like. I think because everybody's so corrupt, right, that you can't really get Putin on invading Ukraine, because that's exactly what Tony Blair did. So we shouldn't do that. So you get him on sort of trafficking children. I think he like took some Ukrainian. Refugee children and you get Trump. You know, and Trump did a lot of highly illegal stuff while he was in office, but very similar stuff to what Barack Obama did. So it's like, okay, well, we'll get him on this thing, this one thing that Barack Obama didn't do. And you get these sort of very tenuous things that people are brought down on, which is totally to do with who they are and not to do with like having an impartial justice system.
Yeah, I guess maybe this
the same with Corbyn getting kicked out of the Labour Party. Like, you kicked out, what was he kicked out for? Nobody can really say. Like,
yeah,
that you kind of match it to, well, it should have applied to other people, but it doesn't. It just applies to him.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's like all of these things, it's not actually the event really that was terribly important or what was said or what was done. It is the overall movement. So even if tomorrow the United States put their hands up and said, oh yeah, we did Nord Stream and fuck you.
Yeah, exactly.
Then that might not make any difference in the overall narrative of everything. However, if there is a genuine anti-war movement that has started to develop for a whole range of other reasons, then that can be the story that ignites everything as that's developing. That's the problem. That's why I say the key thing at the moment is the regressive nature of things. Is that even if there was the spark of something big like that, a particular piece of information coming out, then it would still be minimized. We really need the movement. We really need the whole structure of society to change before that those kind of pieces of information report. I mean, look at the My Lai massacre that was reported by Cy Hirsch, 50 odd years ago, in advance of his report on Nord Stream. quite an amazing journalistic career, that guy. I mean, look at when that happened. That was 1969, I think, that he revealed that. But the reason that it captured the imagination and turned people against the war and turned the media itself against the war was because there was already a strong anti-war movement that had developed since about 67, 68. So it does require, I don't think it's all just about stories. It's the same thing with Corbyn. We could defend Corbyn if there was the strength, if he'd won, if he'd won in 2019, or if he was more popular even more popular in the country. I know he has got a lot of support. But it's about power. In fact, it's the same thing with Julian Assange as well. And part of the documentary Ithaca about Julian Assange, where his wife Stella says that the extradition cases are 1% law and 99% public opinion. Mm. I thought that was really interesting. I don't know if she's a lawyer herself and she specializes in that, so I think she does know what she's talking about. Obviously, she's got an interest in trying to defend her husband. But I thought that was a really telling quote, that essentially what we're talking about really here is these big narratives, power. It's not really about the actual facts of things that determine what happens.
Because you can these bigger factors. You can change. I mean, what Starmer has done is he's changed the rules within the party conference, so that you can get expelled for being part of prescribed groups and stuff. But that's all been done. So like he's done everything by the book, but then he's written the book, right? So that
exactly. Yeah.
And the reason he's been able to do that is because although there is a lot of people in the country who despise him, it's very difficult to make a kind of coordinated movement against him because the media are just very silent on it.
I think that's the thing. It's coordination. You need to have, in fact, again, talking about this a week or two ago with the Galloway panel, because he was sort of saying, everyone's doing great now because we can get get information out through using the internet. And my point on that was just like, I think we still need the mainstream really, because otherwise you are kind of pissing into the wind. Like you do need to be able to turn.
Well, it's an interesting one there because people are moving away from the mainstream because you can have an alternative news sources and alternative communities and a feeling of a movement, because part of it is like
is not the same.
No. Well, it kind of is this. That's what starts a movement in a way. Like in the mainstream, like you feel that you're in a legitimate position because you're getting this reflected back at you a lot, even if it's a real minority opinion, which it can be on some things. Like there are some like really unpopular positions like in this country, like not nationalizing the energy companies. There is no movement behind that, and yet it feels like a justified position because it is echoed by or taken seriously at least by the mainstream media. Obviously, it's put forward by politicians, but lots of things are put forward by politicians which are totally dismissed. But this is one that isn't, and it's put forward by both main parties at this point. But it's like most people don't feel that. But they feel they're up against that, even though there's no one there on the other side. But when it comes to, and you can understand, and you don't feel isolated. If you're just watching mainstream media and you want to nationalize the rail and all you hear is that it can't be done, then you're not involved politically, locally, and you within the Labour Party or any other kind of political organization, then you feel quite isolated. But you can get online and you can see actually there's thousands, millions of people who agree with you. And that can sort of do some, but you're right, we're not there. And you
we're talking about two slightly different things, but they're definitely very closely connected. I think the internet and the diversification of channels is really good potentially for creating movements that they can create connection. Whereas previously that would have been difficult. But I just think to actually enact change, the pressure of change, and also getting in power for policy making, that doesn't affect that. And policy making is, I guess I'm just saying, the people who are in power are really, really in power. Yeah. they're really entrenched. And you need to have a really very, very strong body of people to, and people in the right place to make changes with that. Otherwise,
you have to know that's possible.
But it is possible. Yes, of course it is possible.
And it's in fact, it's the only way.
I'll go back to one of the things about that people listening will probably be despairing and saying, oh, well, what about the Iraq thing? We did the protest march and all that, 1 million people. Well, to me, the fact that we protested there in 2003, I mean, I can't prove it, but I would have thought that would be a fairly important reason why we didn't attack, why our countries didn't attack Iran in 2008, because we came bloody close to it. So I do think that the street movement is important. And I think there were, because of the anti-war movement, there were certain things that Britain and America couldn't do in Iraq to do with oil interests and things. I can't remember the details of that now, but I think the pressure that we brought to bear on the streets, I mean, it certainly wasn't enough to sort out the problem by a long chalk, but I think it probably did have some impact in terms of making the world slightly less awful than it could have been. But we need that again now.
In fact,
it's an indication of just of how important the street movements can be, how fucking awful the things are in Ukraine at the moment, and how there's just no criticism of anything that's been done. So what are we doing? We're funneling in the most terrifying, we're fueling the most terrifying conflict you can possibly imagine. You know, in Iraq, there was with Iraq in 2003, there was the whole thing of like, we're scared of these weapons of mass destruction. We've got to sort that problem out. Now we're just like, oh, yeah, this is a country with like thousands of weapons of mass destruction, and fucking provoke the shit out of that. there was some pretty reasonable people back in 2003 in the center. In fact, I don't mean to derail this too much, but I remember thinking at the time I was obviously opposed to the Iraq war because there weren't weapons of mass destruction. But actually, in addition to that, if there had been, if Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, I would also have opposed the war, because why the fuck are you attacking a country and destroying its capital if it's got weapons of mass destruction? Suicide. Israel would have been annihilated for a start, and then that's the end of that. So I would have opposed that war for any reason. But that again kind of gets into, you kind of need to know to read about it and think about it a bit, and a lot of people just don't have time, and then you've got to create the connections and the movement, and then the movement's got to get some connections within the mainstream, and then that's got to affect policy.
It's a lot of hard work.
Yeah, but try and enjoy it. You know, that's what we're kind of doing.
by not really doing it.
Well, we're not really doing anything, but at least we're talking about it.
Yeah, no, well, that's the thing. It does start with just people, just that sort of instant sort of go-to of like, well, didn't work in Iraq, or like, well, we can't really do anything.
Yeah, well, that's what we don't want.
Labour government would be better than the Tory government, so let's just get that right, you know.
I think that's the thing. You don't want to have the council of despair will say, well, it didn't work for that. And it's like, no, don't go down. Like, things change all the time. I mean, look at the Arab Spring. I mean, look at the kind of changes that happened there. I know that loads of that was reversed and it wasn't, you know, all that. But societies can change very, very rapidly. And you put people at the breaking point, which is what they're doing now with the with fuel prices and cost of living and all that. And we don't really know what the outcomes are going to be. Anything could happen in the next year or two, and it could be major changes. We don't know what's going to happen in the United States, in particular with Trump and the upcoming elections, and indeed his arrest, and whether that, you know, something could spark like that, and we could be in a very, very different world very, very quickly.
I get like a worse world.
Probably.
Because I think there's a feeling, right, that if you meddle, you shouldn't meddle in these things. You shouldn't meddle in the affairs of like the Labour Party in a machinations, or, you know, you should vote. You should vote every 4 or 5 years. God damn, you should vote. But but you shouldn't do anything else, because it's, you know, because again, that's often how it's, you know, people that joined the Labour Party because of Corbyn are just like the most demonized people in this country. And so it's sort of seen as this, not just a thankless task, but you'll just be part of a sort of group of crazies, and, you know.
I don't know if I want to claim the mantle of being the most demonized group of people in the country, but sure.
the demonized people that should be here. No, let's edit that out. You're right. I probably went a bit far with that. But
I know what you're saying. Yeah. I mean, in the context of this show as well, you're talking about a lot of the things you're talking about are war and peace, and also the labor movement. So, yeah.
But I just think it makes people, because I think what you're arguing is right, that things can, and well, inevitably they will change, and they'll change quite quickly at some points. And when that kind of happens, where, you know, what kind of state the left is in is really important, right? And if sort of at this time when it doesn't look the feeling is always like, well, you know, things may slowly get worse, but there's not going to be any radical political change in how the country's run, so I'm just gonna like not bother being involved because it seems like hard work, or, you know, you just get
there's no time like now to do something.
You have to be sort of trying to build up. Not only because it may end up actually coming to something worthwhile, but also just because if you have, like, you know, whether it is through the unions or through some sort of political party or some kind of political,
or a campaign like the Julian Assange campaign. There's been loads of publicity about that lately because of the efforts of his wife. Go on TikTok and go on Instagram and find all those things and like the stories.
If there was a movement like that, if there's a movement of substantial, like something like what was happening 2015, 2016 under Corbyn, if that was happening with Assange now, he would get off.
Yeah. Sounds like it, because of the importance of public opinion.
Yeah. And because it's what they actually have, you know, if people are actually forced to look into what's actually going on, they've it's so groundless what they're doing.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. I think our perspective on international politics, as much as anyone can determine,
if everybody just thought like we.
Yeah, exactly. We've got truth on our side, is what.
And
I was
more
say,
me than you as well. Like, you're quite good, but just me.
You are the purest. your views on the Labour Party. You should run the Labour Party from behind the scenes, like a puppeteer.
Yeah, well, I am Jewish, so.
did they kick you out of the Labour Party?
I'm still a member.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Because I make all my views very public, and clearly Starmer doesn't have any problems with them, it seems. So that's good to know. Yeah, I spoke about this on the last podcast. It's basically, you don't get kicked out for what you say or do. You get kicked out for what you're like, how important you are to the party. So if I ran as a councillor, I'd be kicked out immediately because I'm just the sort of rank and file member. Like, they don't care. It's all nonsense, really, as I'm sure you know. Anyway, should we end it there?
Yes.
Thank you very much, Matt. Do you have anything you want to plug, anything else you want to say, anything, any final words? I don't know when I'll next have you on. It's been so long. Hopefully
it has been a while. I've had a busy time. I guess the thing I try and say at the end of shows these days is to look up the Julian Assange campaign and do something to do with that, even if it's just clicking a few buttons. That's the main thing I'm trying to push at the moment. Other than that, if you want to watch our film Theatres of War, then go on to Vimeo. I think it's $5 or £5, something. And that's good documentary about the CIA and military
Hollywood.
Changing Hollywood film scripts. So
it's got some
good piece of work that you might be interested in.
What's it got? Independence Day? There's like loads of like Hollywood films the military decide what's going to happen in them to make them look good. Yeah.
It is interesting. Yeah. And follow me on Facebook, The Writer With No Hands, if you want to. And feel free to be in touch.
All right. See you later.